Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume. Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
Howdy, folks, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. Y'all are all family. You know how we do this, baby. I'm Cam. Over here is Kyle.
How's it going?
And we are going to have some fun today. We've got some really fun stories. We're going to be discussing some gnomes, little gnome encounters. And then we're going to get into the creepy and the strange. We're going to be talking about some dog man, some listener encounters that's actually happened with the dog man. But before we get into that right quick, Philly, how you been?
I've been good, man. We the snow just started thawing away. And we actually had our first practice baseball game of the season.
How'd the boys
do?
So
glad they did good. We won. I'm glad that baseball's finally back. I'm tired of all this cold weather.
Ready to get out and get moving around. Yeah, I'm ready for some baseball. That's good times. Well, enough of that. And we try to get down to it, folks. And we know everybody appreciates it. We get in here, we BS a little bit, but we're going to jump down to it. But we got some interesting stuff to talk about. Kyle and I have been talking off air quite a bit about these sky sounds, and we've been kicking around all kinds of ideas about it. We should have been recorded the whole time we've been in here talking about it, but we didn't do it. We could have just added it, but usually it's because there's slightly more profanity than what goes on the show, and it's
right?
Me and Kyle yelling about it. But go ahead and let everybody know what we're talking about.
Well, you know,
man,
these sky sounds, these have been reported all over the world, and it seems to be increasing in the amount of times that it's happening from all over. And you can go to YouTube and you can search. There's hundreds of them.
It's the trumpets to the end of the world.
Well, that's what they're claiming. Now, this news story comes to us from Cryptozoology News, you know, and it's about a Davenport resident records some mysterious atmospheric sounds. Now, Davenport is a small town in Iowa, and it says that most people in the state deal with their problems are basically usually from snow and ice accumulations and things like that. But lately, they've been hearing this mysterious atmospheric sound. Now, a computer science student named Matthew Nash, who's 28 years old, told Cryptozoology News on Wednesday that he was clearing out snow and ice by the sidewalk right in front of his house when he heard this strange audio phenomenon. He said, "I was outside salting the sidewalk, and then a loud noise started, and it increased in intensity as I stepped out on my balcony." Now, the student grabbed his cell phone, and then he began to capture this noise. He then made a 2-minute-long YouTube video in which the puzzling harmonics can be heard. So see, it's a little crazy. I don't know what that is. Now, he said, "I told my wife and some fellow students, and all of them were perplexed as well." And he played it back for them, let them listen to it. And but some people seem to think that they have an explanation for these sounds. Now, some people who live in the area said that they're just weather sirens. But Matthew Nash said, "Look, there's no way it could have been weather sirens. I was there that day. I heard the noise, and I heard weather sirens going on later that day, I guess for a storm that was coming in." And he's like, "There's no difference. I mean, there's a huge difference between the two." And it also, He said there was a considerable amount of time between the two, you know, and you can listen to that little clip we played. That doesn't sound like weather sirens to me.
I know what it is.
What?
It is the badass alert siren, because you do know in Davenport, Iowa, is where Pat Miletich started training.
No, I did not know that.
Tim really? Sylvia trained out of there. Drew McFedries, I believe Matt Hughes, Robbie Lawler, of course, Pat Miletich, all of these guys, UFC badasses. That was their siren. They all got together and it alerts when you get too many people in one group like that. That's what it is. It's the badass alert.
It could be.
I can't say what the rest of them are, but I'm just going to tell you that I think that's what that was.
Right. Now, like we were talking about earlier, there's been sounds recorded all over the world with most of the reports peaking around right towards the beginning of 2012, because everybody was, you know, theorizing that it was the end of the world because of the Mayan doomsday prophecy.
Yes.
But people really have, and serious scientists have been trying to come up with what these sounds are. Now, some people think that they're natural phenomenon, natural causes, like earthquakes, also weather phenomenon. Some people think it's hydraulic fracturing or fracking, you know, like fracking wells. But, you know, Matthew Nash says that there's no fracking operations anywhere near Davenport. And he said there is a military base nearby, but he still doesn't think it was either one of those. Now, I have a couple other sounds that I'm going to play here because they kind of sound similar to what Matthew recorded. Now, this one comes from Allen, Texas, which is not very far from here. It's a suburb just north of Dallas. And let's listen to that.
Did you guys hear that?
What is that? It's
weird. I've never heard anything like that before.
Okay, now this was taken in July of last year. Sounds pretty familiar. It sounds very similar to the same noise that this guy's recorded in Iowa, does it not?
Yeah.
Now, here's another sound. This was recorded in August, and this is from Terrace, British Columbia, okay, in Canada. So let's listen to this one. Now, again, all three of those different parts of the world sound pretty similar.
They do. They do sound strangely similar, enough that it's a little unnerving.
I mean, right? Now, what is this thing?
I still think it has to do with something like we've discussed. Maybe it's a little harp action. Maybe it's them messing around with some stuff. Now, I will say this. I have been on jobs where there's been heavy equipment working, and there's lots of times where there'll be heavy equipment like, let's say you got a backhoe and you're digging in the street. Well, lots of times that asphalt is extremely hard. And as the teeth are dragging across that asphalt and that bucket is bouncing, it's almost like there's harmony to it. There's almost like harmonics. Let me say that is, and it reverberates off the walls and off down the alleys in a town or a city. And you can literally hear that blocks and blocks away.
Oh, really?
That exact sound. It will carry a long ways. And it's really strange because No, I've showed up to the job sites and been discussing it with people, and then we'll have the police come because there'll be people talking about it that is literally halfway across town is hearing this sound. But
really?
They don't know where
See,
it
I
comes
did not
from.
Know that.
Yeah, they don't know where it comes from. So I've always wondered, is this something, is it some sort of construction that's going on that's causing this harmonic reverberation, and it just sounds or feels as if it's coming out of the sky? Because some of these sounds I hear do remind me a lot of that construction sound.
Well, that could very well explain it, especially if you're not, you know, like you said, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You're like, man, what is that?
And it will cause a panic, because if you hear that sound and it sounds like it's close, but yet there's nothing around you, I mean, I could only imagine being, like we said, out in the woods in a rural setting, and then that sound is still reverberating out there. Somebody's working in a rock quarry somewhere, and that scraping sound is reverberating just right. Maybe there's enough moisture in the air, some low-hanging clouds. It's bouncing off the clouds and coming back in. And you're like, I'm out in the middle of the woods, and then this sound is coming from, like, it feels like it's coming directly
right,
from
that's
that
exactly
cloud
right.
above me. You will panic.
Well, that's what people think it is. Some people say it's the end of the world. It's the trumpets of the end of the world because the Bible mentions, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to hear trumpets towards the end. But a lot of people think it's this HAARP. Now, if you're not familiar with HAARP, it's just an acronym, H-A-A-R-P, which stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. And it's a...
Say that fast three times.
Right? It's a DARPA creation. It's up in Alaska.
No!
And it's a huge antenna array. And some people theorize that they're using it to control weather and things like that. There's a whole... I mean, we could go into a two-hour show just on HAARP. But I don't know if that's what it is or not, or if it's just, you know, like you're saying... Somebody, machinery, heavy machinery.
Yeah.
Anyways, pretty interesting story.
Well, I got something that's pretty cool for you, brother. We're always talking about a little history, whatnot. There is an Italian mineralogist named Vincenzo De Michele. And he was in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo in 1996, uh-huh. looking at some of the rock and stone that were in some of the old headdresses and old pieces and things that were in the Egyptian antiquities. And he spotted something. In the middle of a necklace that belonged to Tutankhamun.
What was it? A secret decoder ring from like a box of Cracker Jacks? And like, how did that get there?
Basically, it is proof of a meteorite that actually struck the planet. Like we talked about with that blast glass and thing. Get a load of this.
Oh, right on. They made a piece of jewelry out of a meteorite.
It says the jewel was tested and found to be glass. But intriguingly, it is older than the earliest Egyptian civilization. Now, working with the Egyptian geologist Ali Bakrak, they traced its origins to unexplained chunks of glass found scattered in the sand in a remote region in the Sahara Desert. But the glass itself was a scientific enigma. Now, of course, this is they've done a little TV and all that. But anyhow, says an Austrian astrochemist, Christian Kobrel, had established that the glass had been formed at a temperature so hot that there could be only one known cause, a meteorite impacting with Earth. And yet there were no signs of a suitable impact crater, even on satellite images. Now, American geophysicist John Wasson and other scientists interested in the origins of the glass suggested a solution that came directly from the forests of Siberia. Now, get this. When the thought came to me that it required a hot sky, I thought immediately of the Tunguska event.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly what I pictured in my mind, right?
Yeah. Basically, what they're getting at is that there's no sign of a meteoric impact, but scientists now think that the extraterrestrial object of whatever it was must have exploded above Tunguska, like we talked about, and that's what leveled off. Well, now they're kind of going, that whole deal is maybe it exploded above the desert, above Egypt.
Right, yeah.
Is when it did. But this is what it says. Is the simulation revealed that the impact could indeed generate a blistering atmospheric fireball, and the surface temperatures would have reached 1,800 degrees Celsius.
Of the meteorite.
Of the Earth.
Of the Earth.
When it blew up over it, that it could have reached that much.
Man, see?
Which would have turned sand into glass down there.
Well, and we know that this has happened millions upon millions of billions of times over the course of the history of the Earth. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's pretty cool that they found that, and they're like, hey, look, man, this is awesome. Let's make a piece of jewelry out of it.
There are photographs of Barakat holding up these chunks of blast glass that they call it desert glass.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right here.
You see how big that piece is?
That's amazing.
It is unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what's funny to me is if I was over there in Africa, in Egypt, and you see that, you would think it was a rock. You would have no idea that if you knocked that off on the outside and polished it up, it's the beautiful yellow jewel that was carved into a scarab that's in Tutankhamun's necklace.
Yeah, you would have no idea.
You see that, you're like, oh, so there's, that's just it. Now they know that it didn't, may have not it struck, but it blew up over there. So if that's what it was, we were legitimately in a shooting gallery.
So we still
are. Was, yeah, and if they were any civilization and that blew up over a village over a, if that blew up over New York right now.
No.
And it, imagine what
everybody's
it would
do. Dead.
It destroys everything.
Yeah.
So, like, what is it Charlton Heston says at the beginning of Armageddon? It's happened before and it will happen again.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Did you see this, speaking of ancient history? There's a new article in the Daily Mail about, did humans occupy Western U.S. earlier than thought?
I did see that, and I got all pumped up.
Right?
Yeah,
they said that they recently found an ancient knife that suggests that people were hunting in that area 16,000 years ago.
Holla!
Right, now that's pretty cool. Now, the article goes on to say that archaeologists have uncovered a stone tool in Oregon that suggests that humans occupied the Western United States earlier, much earlier than thought. Now, the tool was uncovered under a thick layer of volcanic ash, dating back to the eruption of Mount St. Helens 15,800 years ago. So not when it erupted recently, but the time before.
Yeah, the time before the last eruption. Talking about repeating. You know? Bad
exactly.
Things happening, repeating.
Now, they believe that this primitive knife discovered 12 feet below the ground was used for cutting animal hides, butchering meat, and carving wood by this pre-Clovis people culture. So pre-Clovis people.
That's pretty awesome, yeah.
Now, for a long time, they thought that the Clovis people probably were the first people here, but apparently this was from before that. Now, Donald Grayson, who's a professor of archaeology at the University of Washington, states that the scientific community will be skeptical until more tests are done. They said no one is going to believe until it is shown that there was no break in the ash layer, that the artifact could not have worked its way from higher up and then worked its way down. But he said they're going to continue to do studies on this thing, and they're going to try to prove that it's pre-Clovis. Now,
that is so cool, man.
Most scientists accept the idea that the Clovis group of Indians were some of the earliest of this time. Now, if the date of this Rimrock knife holds up, that means that these people at this site were around 1,500 years earlier than what they think of now, which would be right during the end of the Pleistocene era. There would have been mastodons at that time, mammoths, camels, horses.
The woolly rhinos. The
all that stuff would have been around.
Sloths.
So what you're finding is, man, more and more stuff. Now, they do say that they're, now that they found this, that they're going to be going back this coming summer, and they're going to be doing a lot more excavating in that area. Who knows what they might find? They might find a whole...
Might lead you to more stuff.
Civilization there. I mean, it'd be
things
cool.
Seem to keep getting older and older.
I love it.
And older.
I love it.
Well, with you saying that, and I know there's a lot of people have seen this, and I can't go without addressing it. I know there's a lot of other shows, a lot of people have talked about it. I can't go without addressing this, is the fact that they believe they have found the lost city, the White City, or the City of the Monkey God in Honduras.
Right? I'd always think of Indiana Jones.
I do. The minute I saw this, I was so pumped up. I couldn't, I wanted to be part of this. It's one of those things. I want to be part of this. For those of you that aren't aware of what's going on, there was Douglas Preston actually wrote this for National Geographic. You can also go to Ancient Origins and check it out. They do. Miss Holloway, April Holloway, does a great article on it also. Basically, what ended up happening is this. 2 years ago, there was an aerial search of dense jungle. Now, the reason they're doing an aerial search is because this kind of started back in the 20s. And she says, of course, in 1927, there was a pilot named Charles Lindbergh. And he reported seeing monuments that he said was constructed out of white stone while he was flying over eastern Honduras. Now, that wasn't the only one. There were several adventurers back in the 30s that went off into the jungles in there and claimed to have come back with things and would come back with these different artifacts. And the one fellow that had returned with a lot of this stuff named Theodore Morde, he said that that he had found this city and that there was a giant statue of a monkey god that was buried there. He never would tell anybody where it was at. He claims because he didn't want it to be looted, but he probably just, you know, was wanting to be a little, you know, mine, covet the thing, which you can't blame him. But he ended up passing away before he ever revealed where it was all at. So you fast forward all these years to 2 years ago. They were doing some aerial search, basically flying over with the radar and things like that. And they went to looking part of this in this one specific part of Honduras because of local legend. Well, they ended up finding what they thought was miles of man-made features. Well, turns out they was right.
Really?
Turns out these were man-made features. They sent an expedition in there into the jungle, and that's pretty much what they found. Now, archaeologists surveyed and mapped, get this, extensive plazas, earthworks, mounds, and, like we've been talking about, it's always been debatable, but they found an earthen pyramid in there that's belonged to a culture that they say thrived 1,000 years ago and then vanished. And it's so little is known about it that this culture has no name. They don't even know what they're going to call it. They haven't been able to link it to anything. And also, they haven't really been able to study it the way they want to. Now, the team, which they returned from the site this past Wednesday, had discovered a cache of stone sculptures that had laid untouched since the city was abandoned. Now, they say, in contrast to the nearby Maya in that area, that this vanished culture has been scarcely studied and is virtually unknown.
That's crazy.
Now, here's a cool thing. Christopher Fisher, now, he's a Mesoamerican archaeologist, and he's part of the team. Now, he's from Colorado State University. He said that the pristine, unlooted condition of the site is incredibly rare, and that they have found all kinds of these offerings at this one little pyramid structure.
Uh-huh.
And he said that it's a powerful ritual display because he knows that it had to be something of wealth. These objects meant something to somebody and they left them there. But apparently that they found 52 artifacts sticking up out of the ground even. And some are decorated vessels with snakes, zoomorphic figures, vultures, ceremonial seats. There's even a carving of a were-jaguar that they believe depicts a shaman in transformation from spirit state.
See, now what is that?
No clue, but I am so freaked out. But here's the thing. They came back. They didn't bring anything back. They took pictures, took measurements. They didn't tell anybody. They did nothing. They just come back. They're getting all their stuff together. Then they're going to go back and put it in lockdown. So they went to make sure it was right. When they found out that it was right, they're like, perfect. We're going to go back and take this.
They
thing.
Better
so,
before people start looting.
Right. So we're going to, this is going to be an ongoing subject that we'll probably be really keeping an eye on.
That's awesome, folks. We're going to take a break here, but stick with us after the break. We're going to get into some stories about gnomes and dogmen sightings. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. We're back with Expanded Perspectives. Those are some interesting news stories. I really like that whole sky sound phenomenon. I mean, it's bizarre. I just don't know. I don't know what it is. A part of me, you know, thinks that it's just construction or something like that. And another part of me thinks of that, you know, that harp.
Yeah.
You know, anyways, you were talking to me yesterday about how you had uncovered recently some interesting stories about gnomes.
Yes.
And people and listeners of the show for a long time know your deep love for fae folk and fairy stories. Mm-hmm. And I, too, I mean, I have to admit, they're pretty intriguing. You know, when it comes to duendes, elves, whatever these things are. And I love the stories because some of them, I mean, it's just like what you see on TV or cartoons. I mean, they have like a little cap on, a little pipe, a little beard. I mean,
strange.
It is bizarre. So tell us what you found out.
Well, I guess kind of what got me down... It's been shows, several episodes ago, good friend of the show, Mr. Jason Smith, had sent us some information on duendes, where they had an encounter with some in Colorado, and then one of the fellas that he worked with had an encounter with some in South Texas. And I had found another duendy story that took place in South Texas, much like the story that they had told about them coming into a home and all this, but this wasn't like a home being built or remodeled. It was just they had spotted these duendes. And I don't know, I just the duendy thing, and it's the same thing all the time. It snowballs, you know, I get to reading something, boom, it snowballs. So I got to looking more and more into these gnome stories, and some of them aren't, some of them are mischievous, and that seems to be like the most thing is like they're having fun, and it's like the minute you see them, it's when they go, oh, now I can mess with you. You know, now right? I'm going to kind of pester you. And I'm going to give you a little story. This actually happened in March of 2003 in Houston, Texas.
Uh-oh, this happened in Texas?
Yeah. It says, the witness noticed his dog chasing something in the yard, thinking it was a cat. He went out to investigate and yell at his dog. Now, before we go any further, we have had the story before of the dogs chasing one and it got caught. And then, you know, and it was carrying. But it says, But when he got there, he saw a 1-foot-tall figure wearing red clothing, something resembling a clown suit without the big shoes and nose. He wore a pointy red hat and had a white beard. The witness called his dog over to him. He pulled him inside and closed the door, then looked out the window to see the figure eating bird seed in the yard. As he looked out, the gnome-like figure looked straight at him. It seemed to become afraid and hid behind the porch. The witness called out, and the small figure peeked over the porch at him and smiled and then disappeared.
What? Now, I love those stories. Well, I mean, and just like I was talking about, I mean, it's exactly what the description of a gnome should be.
Well, and you're exactly right. And that's what we're going to talk. Look, right quick, we'll get into some stuff about the gnomes. Now, gnomes first appeared in the works of 16th century Swiss alchemist Paracelsus. And they're not really sure if he actually made up the term itself or if it became from like a Latin term gnomus. But basically, the word itself originates from the term earth dweller. Is where they get this. Now, of course, if you read anything about them, do any study, it's always said that they're very spiritual beings and they inhabit the spirit realm of like earth, like an earth elemental, if you would. So when people think about that, like some Wiccan beliefs and things, there's elementals. So they have that these are like earth energies or earth spirits. And like we just discussed, most of the time, commonly, you can imagine that they're invisible to the average person. And then, like we've talked about, where people seem to see them, and then that's when they're like, hee-hee, then they start messing around, just like that. He was kind of hidden. When he found out the dude wasn't coming after him, he kind of looked up and gave him this little mischievous grin and then took off, right?
Right.
They also said, of course, in a lot of other folk tales, that gnomes are kind of like the protectors of hidden treasures or something secret, like, and they keep them in the caves and things, because gnomes are said to live underground. I mean, you think back to the gnomes and stuff that are used in J.R.R. Tolkien's. When you talk about Lord of the Rings, you talk about the elves, the gnomes, the dwarves. Well, the dwarves and the gnomes are kind of basically the same thing.
Yeah.
So that's the whole idea behind it. Well, Jason Offit actually has a really cool tale. Comes from his blog spot, From the Shadows. It's from -the-shadows, and it's a blog spot. And it actually, he's got a new, you know, he wrote a book called What Lurks Beyond, and it was paranormal in your backyard and stuff. Now, there's a lot of these things coming, but this is a From the Shadows thing, and it reads this way here. It says, Dan Bortko's family moved from Wyandotte County, Kansas, to Liberty, Missouri in 1948, when he was about 9 months old. Now, his family didn't know it, but something had already lived in the house on High Street. The house, a stucco bungalow built atop a hill in the 1920s, wasn't the only structure on that site. There was a spring in the basement, Bortko said. The site of the spring was the site of a large farm from the 1860s through 1914. Our property was the part of the farmyard at some time. A barn still sat outside the 2-bedroom house when the Bortkos moved there. In that house in 1952, Bortko saw something that has haunted his mind ever since. Says, I call him a troll because that's what he reminded me of. Regardless of the name, troll, gnome, dwarf, goblin, these diminutive human-like earth creatures have littered cultural mythology across the globe and are known to approach and sometimes abduct children. Now, of course, Dan was 4 at the time, napped in the same room as his 2 younger brothers, both in cribs. And he said something woke him up. And when his eyes opened, he realized that him and his baby brothers weren't alone in the room.
Ooh.
Said, I had just awakened from a nap and was rubbing my eyes and saw what you would call a troll. It was an old man with a long beard, large nose, about 3 feet tall, standing at the foot of my bed.
Man.
How scary would that be at the time?
Right? I mean, I could not imagine.
Now, this goes back to what you just said here. It says, the little old man wore German lederhosen,
right,
and held a smoking pipe in his hand. As the little old man stood looking at Bortko, he smiled through his beard, winked, and disappeared through the closet door. Now, Dan says, the only thing I could mutter was, oh, gosh. My mother came in, opened the closet door, and on the top shelf, there was a toy rubber goose. Now, Bortko knows he didn't say goose, the word goss had something to do with his troll. Now, although Bortko doesn't think he saw the little man again, later in life, his mother told him he often talked about someone no one else could see. Says, as a child, my mother said I had an imaginary friend, and I called it by its name. He said, my mother said it sounded like a science fiction movie name. Now, during this time, Dan remembers looking out his bedroom window at night and seeing people near the barn in the backyard. He said, little people. He said, that's what scared me. They were fairy tales pictured on my wall. There was a man on the mountain smoking a pipe, and this reminded me of him. Now, as a child, he's now an artist with a master's degree in photography. Bortko is here, and he said he tried to capture this little man on paper. He said, I remember doing a drawing of a picture of a man's face with large dark eyes, and my brother Bill started crying. Every time he saw it, he was out of his wits. All right, now he says maybe he wasn't the only person in the house at the time that saw this. Now, get a load of this one. It says David Schwab is 52. He grew up in Orange, New Jersey, and is familiar with the tales of a similar thing. Now, his friend Jerry once saw a troll in the 1960s. Says, I remember Jerry talking about some kind of troll or leprechaun or elf or something. Some kind of critter, he said, with a long beard that was on his steps.
That's, every time I hear the description, it really, I mean, all jokes aside, it would be terribly creepy to see something like that. To me,
yes.
But also, I kind of wished I could see something like that.
I would love to see something like that. I would love, it's one of those things, I would love to witness things like this. This gets wild. Get this, it says, he said that when he was a kid, he was in his backyard and was startled by a small gnome-like man with a long beard standing by his back porch. He said he had funny clothes on and a pointed hat and all. Says the entity was 2 or 3 feet tall. It just stood at the step staring at him. So this wasn't the last time the gnome made an appearance at Jerry's house. So when he was in his 20s, his 5-year-old nephew took a nap in a converted bedroom his family called the shower room because it had once been a bathroom, and a shower head still just stuck out from the wall. Said his nephew started crying and ran downstairs. Jerry said that he was woken by a small man with a long white beard that stood and looked at him.
Hmm.
Now, this isn't something new in this area, okay?
Okay.
On September 3rd of 1609, there was a fellow named Henry Hudson, and he sailed the Half Moon, a ship called the Half Moon, into the mouth of the great New York River that later, of course, bore his name, the Hudson River.
Right.
Now, the explorer and his crew journeyed north for several days, trading with the native residents and searching for the fabled Northwest Passage to the Orient. But by the time he had reached the area that would become present-day Albany, Hudson knew that he had not found the passage for which he sought, and reluctantly he turned the Half Moon around and sailed back down the river. Now that night, Henry and his crew anchored the ship in the shadow of the Catskill Mountains, and around midnight, Hudson heard the sound of music floating across the mountains and down to the river. Now, taking a few members of his crew, he went ashore and followed the sound up and into the Catskills. The sound of the music grew louder as Hudson and his men marched up to the edge of the precipice. And to their astonishment, a group of pygmies with long, bushy beards and eyes like pigs were dancing and singing and capering about in the firelight.
Are you kidding me?
He goes on to say that Hudson realized that these creatures were the metalworking gnomes of whom the natives had spoken. Metalworking gnomes.
I've never heard of that.
Right? That says, one of the bushy-bearded chaps spotted the explorer and his men and welcomed them with a cheer. The short men surrounded the crew and drew them to the firelight and the dance. Hudson and his men were delighted with these strange small creatures and the hard liquor that the gnomes had brewed. Long into the night, the men drank and played nine pins with the gnomes while Henry Hudson sipped at a single glass of spirits and spoke with the chief of the gnomes about how many deep and mysterious things. Now, realizing at last how late it was, Hudson looked around for his men, and at first he couldn't locate them. All he saw was large groups of gnomes laughing and joking as they sprawled around the fire. Then, to his astonishment, he recognized several of the gnomes as his crewmen. They had undergone a transformation. Their heads had swollen to twice their normal size, their eyes were small and pig-like, and their bodies had shortened until they were only a little taller than the gnomes themselves.
His men had turned into gnomes?
That's the way the story goes, yes. Now it
says, see, now that's why if you're ever out in the woods,
you don't take what the fae give you.
Don't be drinking and playing games with them. That's
eating? You're not supposed to take any of that.
No, you're right. Yeah. You're right.
Says Hudson was alarmed and asked the chief of the gnomes for an explanation. It was the chief explained to Hudson the effect of the magical hard liquor the gnomes had brewed. It would wear off when the liquor did. Hudson wasn't sure he believed the little man and afraid of what else might happen to him and his crew if they continued to linger in such company. So they took off. So, of course, like he grabs up his drunken buddies and they head back to the ship. That says the entire crew slept till late in the morning And he's, Hudson goes on to say, as if they were kind of under some kind of sleeping spell. That's how long they slept. You got to think, men back then, you know, it was when the sunlight hits you, you're up. Boom, you're rocking. You know what
That's true. And the Fae might brew some really wicked whiskey, right? Yeah.
He said that when they woke up, the men were back to normal, but had horrible, horrible headaches. Now, of course, he continued back down the river, and by October 4th, he had reached the mouth of the Hudson, and his crew sailed for home. Now, in 1610, Hudson set off on another journey searching for the Northwest Passage to the Orient. Trapped in the ice through a long winter, Hudson's crew eventually mutinied and set Henry Hudson and 8 of his crewmen adrift in the Hudson Bay, and of course, they were never seen again. Now, in September of 1629, 20 years to the day that Hudson and his crew met the Catskill Gnomes, a bright fire appeared on the precipice above the hollow, and dance music could be heard floating through the mountains. And the Catskill Gnomes spent the evening dancing and carousing and drinking their magic liquor. And at midnight, they were joined by the spirits of Henry Hudson and his crew. Now, that's kind of the way this whole thing shakes out. Now, they say that every 20 years, the spirits of Henry Hudson and his crew return to the Catskills Mountains to play ninepins with the gnomes.
Now, what is ninepins?
That's some kind of, I think, a...
Just like a yard game?
Just like a yard game.
You know, like playing washers?
Yeah. Now, of course, that right there comes, it's from a book called Spooky New York, Tales of Hauntings, Strange Happenings, and Other Local Lore by S.E. Schlosser. Now, this isn't just here in the States. Over in the U.K., it's happened in a place called the Woollinton Park Incident. Now, this actually took place in 1979, October 29th, to be exact, in Nottingham, in a swampy area called Wallington Park. All right? Now,
okay. It
says the witnesses were a small group of children aged 8 to 10, and the events took place in September of 79 at the park. It says the grounds, they were in the park grounds at 8:30 p.m. when it was getting dark, but they were still a little light to see by. And in a swampy area in the trees, of course, fenced off from the public, the children saw about 6 little men, about half as tall as themselves. Now, they had long white beards with red tips and wrinkled faces. They wore caps on their heads, described as being like old-fashioned nightcaps, which makes me think of the hats like the Seven Dwarfs wear.
That's right, yeah.
And they said, naughty style with a bobble on the end. They also wore blue tops and yellow tights. For most of the 15 minutes that the children spent with them, the little men were in little cars. They were 30 cars with 2 men in each. The cars didn't have steering wheels, but a round thing with a handle to turn. There was no sound of engines, but they traveled fast and could jump over obstructions like logs. They were also seen up in trees, coming out of and returning to the holes. The children felt like they could only come out after dark. Now, despite the disbelief of their parents when they told them about the little men, the children were adamant that they were not making up stories.
Mm-hmm.
They also claimed to have seen the little people before, during the long summer holiday. Now, their headmaster interviewed and recorded them separately, and soon after, and despite a few discrepancies in their accounts and differences on emphasis, the children's stories remained the same.
That's crazy.
But there was also other sightings. Now, over 6 years before these fairies or these little gnomes were seen that were actually reported to the media, it was actually reported that there was a sighting, I think, 4 years ago around 1940. And this woman says that one night she and her older sisters, all sleeping in one bedroom, awoke to hear a buzzing noise and looked out the window. They saw a little man in a tiny red car driving around in circles, and that he was about 18 inches tall, had a white beard and a droopy pointed hat. Right?
It's mind-boggling, but I love these stories. I've even heard of a story where some children were playing outside, I believe in England, and they saw what looked like a miniature like biplane.
Yes, I remember
flying,
that
flying, and they said they could see it. There was a little man flying the plane.
I remember that one, too, yeah.
What is that?
I don't know. Well, here's one more for you.
Okay.
This comes from Rough River State Park in Kentucky, all right, from the summer of 2003, all right? Now, this was actually printed on ParanormalAbout.com, and some of it was actually printed in a Louisville, Kentucky newspaper a few days after it went down. Now, here's the original, all right? It says, June 24th of 2003, in mid-afternoon, the witness was on a weekend canoeing trip for rest and relaxation in a remote area of Rough River State Park. He was strangely queasy and anxious for some unknown reason. For some unknown reason, he felt like he had had something to fear. Now, heeding these sensations, he was extremely cautious on the river. And after several miles, he paddled the canoe to the riverbank and tied it off on a tree. He got out to explore the area, and he said, looking down, you know, looking 8 to 10 foot downstream, said he spotted what looked like the top of a gray clay jar sticking up out of the water.
Hmm.
Said his first thoughts was maybe he had found some native artifacts there.
Right.
So he started down the bank on the creek there to get what in some real slippery mud, of course, to get close to the jar. And he stopped just short of the water and very close to the old earthen pot. He said it was more like a clay crock. He soon realized that it probably wasn't very old. He poked at it and noticed that there were small handprints on it.
What?
Yeah. He thought it could have been a raccoon.
Right.
But then
yeah.
The more he looked, they looked like little human handprints about an inch wide. Said he tried to pry the thing loose using a stick, but suddenly heard a noise. He heard what sounded like children laughing in the distance. The sound was coming from downstream. Now, when he managed to pull the crock jar out of the mud, something let out a scream. It sounded like a little girl, very high-pitched and loud. Now, not knowing what to do, he grabbed the jar and began to scramble up the bank, like we would all do. You know, you got to
kind of panic
and you run. Looking back over his shoulder, he said he thought he saw something move along the creek. So he stopped, sat at the top of the bank for the moment, looking at the jar and trying to figure out these handprints. After a few minutes, he set it down and he set it down and got up and walked along the creek, stopping every once in a while to peek into the bushes, you know, look through, see if anybody was there. And at one point, he looked over the bank and noticed two little people standing about a foot tall. They had pale skins, little brown leather pants held up by suspenders. No shirts and little pointy hats made of what looked like leather. They had leather foot coverings that went up past the ankle. Their hair was reddish in color and their eyes were blue. Their hands were only about, you ready, an inch wide.
Mm.
They knew he was watching, but they continued their task of pulling some kind of wooded stump down the muddy creek bank with long leather ropes or strings. Says these little men were surprisingly clean for the work they were doing. He then heard a thump back where he first had gone in the creek. He looked back and there were three more of the little men, exactly like the first two. They had pushed the crock jar back down the bank. They were all laughing, high-pitched laughter, like a bunch of kids. He then heard a loud snap, and they were all gone. Said their footprints were plainly visible in the mud, but they were gone along with the crock jar and this wooded stump. They had all vanished in a split second. He walked around in an attempt to pick up the trail and never could. So he jumped back in the canoe and took off. Never saw anything else the rest of the time he was on it.
Man, that is insane. But you know what? This is very similar to a lot of the stories I've heard before about these nature spirits.
Yep.
Even American Native Americans have stories of little people. And some of them speak about it very frankly. Like, oh, yeah, I remember when I was a kid, the little people used to come around and play on the porch and we'd leave them a snack or something.
Yes. Yeah, you're right.
And most people just, if you didn't mess with them, they didn't mess with you. I've even heard you can get some of the little people to start coming around if you build them a little tiny fairy house and stick it outside. I've heard of people. I mean, even like a friend of the show, Mary Valdez, spoke one time about a woman had fairies and they were doing mischief around the house. And if she built them a little fairy house, they would stop. And so the woman did.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff stopped.
Yeah.
So, you know, much like any of the other stories we do on the show, there are absolutely some that are probably completely fabricated.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
But there also are a ton that aren't fabricated. And these fae folk stories, they've been around for as long as time. I mean, I remember in a book I purchased about a year ago, Seeing Fairies, it's talking about this. It's about the lady Majorie Johnson. And she was a secretary of the Fairy Investigation Society, which has been founded from like the 1800s. And it was a society dedicated to tracking and keeping track of all these fairy stories. Now, the book is called Seeing Fairies, and you can get it at Anomalist Books or Amazon. And what's so cool about it is there's literally about 400 sightings from all around the world in that book of nothing but fae folk, gnomes, things like that. And, you know, in that book, not just the small cars or the small airplanes like we mentioned before, but people have told stories of seeing small, like, kitchen stoves, tiny sewing machines, tiny typewriters. I mean, it is
really
bizarre.
Really bizarre, strange
things. It's like,
things.
What is this? Is it something, I mean, obviously not everybody can be hallucinating this because sometimes multiple people see it.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? And it's what's really cool is it's like they're doing their stuff and then they notice you notice them and then they're gone.
Well, and they're always laughing and jovial, but they're also always working. It seems they're like they're something. Always busy. They're busy. I know I've said it before, folks, but it's like the machine elves. You hear people when they talk about these psychedelic trips they go on. It's like these little machine elves in the background that are keeping all this stitched together. I guess the thing that always gets me is this. Nobody reports seeing them driving. Nobody report. It's always whenever you are at your most calm. It's when you seem to be one with nature. Like this fella talks about, he was by himself, or a lot of children. Children are in the park. They're enjoying the outdoors. You really give yourself over to the outdoor experience. And when you do that, it seems like that's whenever you kind of get back in tune with these things. And it really seems that way. Just like he talked about seeing one while on a canoe trip. You're by yourself. You're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I know that I have been kayaking and canoeing, and you can slip right up on animals that normally you wouldn't. Like, there may be deer watering that would normally freak out, but you're so quiet and they don't really know what you are that you just appear out of nowhere on them. And maybe that has a lot to do with it. Maybe it is. It's almost like you're getting into that tone. We've talked about it numerous times in the past, is you kind of get into that sequence, that frequency, and that's what allows you to kind of see through this veil and go, oh, those little suckers have always been here. I'm just now getting to see them.
I know, right? It is really cool. If there's anybody out there listening that has had a Dwendy encounter or a fairy or a gnome or anything, please email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. I would love to hear about it.
I love them.
Even if you don't want us to read it on air, I would love to hear about it.
Yeah, I love it.
Because I've only met two people that have ever had actual sightings. One was Jason Smith and Mike Cleland. He actually had a sight one time when he was hiking and backpacking one time. And that was pretty cool. Well, I'm going to move on. Let's move on to some Dogman
stories. We're going to shift gears and get into something really creepy now.
Now, this first story comes from a Northern Illinois resident named Ann Dakin. Now, back in 2002, she says, I saw a Dogman in McHenry, Illinois. We were on Route 31, southbound, returning from Elgin, from Waukesha, Wisconsin, after the funeral of my mother-in-law very late at night. The sighting was just south of the shopping area, before Route 31 Dog Legs, perpendicular to a cemetery on the west side of the road. Somewhere around 2 a.m., on April 29, 2002, as we approached the residential area south of the cemetery, I noticed glowing eyes and a dark shape off to my left. Being fairly close to the Nipissing flowage, I always kept my eyes peeled for deer through that area. I came to a complete stop as the dark shape rose out of the gully on the east side of the road to my left. It went from all fours to two legs, and as it crossed in front of the headlights, almost as if it was annoyed by our presence, it turned and looked at our truck, menacingly, curling its lip briefly, as if in a snarling fashion. Then it finished crossing the road, and as it left the pavement, it returned to all fours, ran down into the gully, up on the other side, and loped into the cemetery, where it was too dark for me to follow its progress. Now my husband was sound asleep, understandably, as the previous 2 days had been exhausting for him, with his mom's funeral and all. I made a tiny attempt to wake him up, but since the phenomenon had already occurred, I decided just to let him sleep. Now, the creature looked like an upright, walking wolf. Its forearms were in a position not unlike the way a kangaroo holds its arms. The thighs were very powerful and strong-looking, and it had an elongated nose and a long, bushy tail. It was walking on its back toes, and it crossed in front of me. It seemed to be a little over 6 feet in height. The top of my truck is almost 6 feet high, and it crossed so close to the front of the truck that I could judge its height quite well, and it seems to be a little bit taller than the top of my windshield. The experience I had was a very surreal thing, as if the portion of time that it had spent crossing the road was eerily slowed down a bit, making what I could have only taken a few seconds seems to be about 10 seconds longer. Needless to say, it was weird, and yes, no one believes me. Now, Miss Dakin added in a later interview that its fur was medium gray, tipped with a reddish brown, and that it had an upright pointed ears with tufts at least a half inch long. Its eyes displayed a deep yellow eyeshine from the headlights. I was looking more at its snarling mouth and at its odd behavior of walking on its hind legs than anything else. Now, Linda Godfrey, in her new book, American Monsters, talks about this case specifically, and she says that this encounter was a fairly typical one, not just for its proximity to the cemetery, but because so many sightings are made at night by passing motorists as a creature either crosses the road or lurks near the shoulder. Its description is a good standard for the upright canine nationwide, although dark brown is probably more prevalent in color. The other features are similar. The long muzzle, forelimb position, the muscular thighs are all common characteristics. And finally, its behavior is classic, staring innocently at the eyewitness, snarling as it proceeds on its hind legs to wherever it's headed. All of those factors tend to ensure that encounters with man-wolves, as I often call them, in order to emphasize their upright stance while leaving out baggage that comes from the word werewolf, are engraved in the memories of most eyewitnesses. Many reports that I receive concern incidents only decades old, but the witnesses always say they remember their encounters as if they had just happened. Now, Linda Godfrey, in her new book, goes on to mention that a Virginia woman who had a similar sighting wrote to her back in 2008. And this sighting happened back in 1991 as they drove through North Carolina one night on their way to a Florida vacation. Now, the person that wrote the letter says that they had been forced to take a detour from the freeway to a foggy two-lane county road. And they were listening to music and chatting as they continued south. Suddenly, they saw a large, gray, furry critter with glowing green eyes and teeth showing as it ran across the road on its hind legs. I suspect the glowing came from our headlights, the reflection of them, much like when hunters are out hunting at night. The creature was moving very fast through the fog. It was around 40 yards ahead of them. They estimated it stood around 7 feet tall, and it looked wolfish around the head, but its body didn't look human. It seemed to be simply more than just a wolf standing up. My friend and I both were silent for quite a while, and I finally said, "Did you see that?" And my friend responded, "What was that?" I said it looked like a werewolf, and she agreed that it definitely looked like it could be one, although not really anything like some of the grotesque and distorted creatures you see in Hollywood. Just something, somehow, that looked like a cross between a dog or wolf and a human. It was really disturbing. We got the hell out of there and into the next truck stop diner that we could find, got back on the highway, and drove straight to Florida without any more detours. Still talking about whatever that thing was, that memory creeps me out to this day. Now, another case of an upright canid happened in October of 2010. Now, a woman named Rachel Genderau was traveling through Illinois when her and her husband saw something bizarre. She says, around 10:30 p.m. or so, my fiancé and I were traveling back home from Galena, Illinois. We were at least 8 miles out of Galena on a back road called Black Jack Road. When we got to a fairly curvy part in the road, this road is heavily wooded on both sides, and there are not many homes where we were at this time. We noticed a large figure running out of the woods ahead of us. When we got closer, as we were driving 50 miles per hour, we distinctly saw a 6 to 7 foot tall wolf running on its hind legs. It paused to look directly at us before leaping at a great speed off of the road and back into the woods. My fiance and I just looked at each other in pure shock, and he asked if we should turn around and go look for it. I, however, was so frightened, I just wanted to get off that road quickly. We have never shared this story with anyone. And just a couple weeks ago, when another friend of ours shared their recent sighting with us, I decided to tell them ours. Now, she said that the creature was not only illuminated by their headlights, but by the bright moonlight. As it paused, it turned its head to stare at them. Its eyes displayed a bright white eye shine. I felt it was looking right through me, as if it knew me. Now, right after that, the creature resumed running across the road and leaped over a wire fence on the other side to disappear into the trees behind us. Rachel saw its legs clearly and said they were canine in structure and that it definitely had paws rather than hands and feet. She noticed that its body was dark gray fur. and was a bit sparser on its chest than on the rest of its body, and that it had a long snout. Now, Rachel's fiancé, Chris, wrote that without question, my girlfriend and I encountered this on our drive from Galena, Illinois, to Savannah, Illinois, at night on a rural road. It was standing on its back legs in the road. When we initially saw it, our brains couldn't quite process what it was fast enough. After we passed it, I could see it just staring at us from the rearview mirror. Our hearts were pounding, and we drove like hell. We know what we saw. Now, from time to time, we get listeners that email the show some pretty outstanding and pretty amazing stories. And recently, I got one from a young lady named Alice Ranger. And she had a bizarre encounter when she was younger. And I will read that for you now. She says, here goes my story. I have never shared this experience with anyone outside my immediate family. When I saw your video the other day about dog men and heard that other people with similar encounters, I felt a huge weight lifted off my shoulders. Is it possible that what I saw many years ago was real? We lived in a small two-bedroom frame house. Now, this house sat on a large lot that backed up to a large wooded creek. My dad sometimes had to work very late. My mother, with three small daughters, would always stay up to wait for my dad. We had a large German shepherd tied in the yard because we had no fence around our home. Now, it was around midnight when my mother came into my room and woke me up. The first thing I was aware of was the wild barking of our dog in the yard and the pulling of his chain. My mother told me to be very quiet so as not to wake up my sisters. I was about 10 years old at this time. She told me to sit by the bedroom window and look out. I looked out and I could see our dog going crazy with rage. I never saw him act this way before. I looked in the direction of where he was looking. We had a very large oak and pecan tree in our backyard, about 10 feet from each other. I saw nothing. My mother told me to keep looking at the two large oak trees that were about 10 feet from the dog. She told me that she was going into the kitchen and for me to stay at the window in the bedroom and keep my eyes on the first tree. She had all of the lights off in the house, and we had a very large and bright light in the backyard. She told me to stay looking out the window, and she was going to the kitchen, and she was going to turn the light off. She said she would turn it back on in a couple of seconds, and for me to keep my eyes on that first oak tree. This made no sense to me, but I obeyed. She went to the kitchen, and she was looking out the back door window. She turned off the light in the backyard. I instantly saw a very tall and large figure step out from behind the big oak tree and walk slowly to the second oak tree in the direction of our dog. Before it got to the second oak tree, my mom turned the light back on and I got a very clear view. I know this sounds crazy, but this is what I saw. A large dog walking on two legs. It was tall and had dark fur. It had a long snout, and its legs had the shape of a muscular dog. Its arms were up in front of him. It walked to the second tree and stood behind it. This thing was not scared of our dog. My mom kept the light on. She came back to the bedroom where I was, and she asked me what I saw. I told her. She said she saw the same thing, but needed someone else to confirm it. She said she saw it walk out of the creek upright. This creek was deep and steep. She said she had been watching it for hours. As we looked, it just stayed there, but we could see the curve of its legs and the snout sticking out from behind the tree. After about 10 minutes or so, not very long, it walked back down into the creek. The strange thing was how it could go down into the creek with such ease. I've never forgotten this. My mom has long since passed away, and a few times we talked about it when we tried to make sense of all this. We had never heard of the dog man. We had no close by neighbors. This was too big to be any animal, and it definitely was not human. To this day, We both agreed on what we saw. So, I mean, what an incredible story.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, I don't even know what to say to that, but you know what I will say to this? My hat's off to her mother for having the wherewithal to think about, I'm not going to, you know, because I'm afraid if I had seen something, I'd be like, Kyle, get over here. I just saw an effing wolf man out the back.
Right.
And you don't need to do that. I need to see, I like the fact that she's like, just go look. Go watch right there.
She doesn't want to plant any seeds in her mind. I just want you to do this for me real quick.
Just go check it out.
Just to kind of see. Because I guess her mother has been watching it for hours. She probably thought to herself, what's a way I can get my oldest daughter to confirm what I'm seeing without implanting any kind of ideas?
Now, Jeff, before you get crazy, nobody's shooting the wolf man tonight, bro. We're just checking this out, man. We're just talking about these women seeing it.
Yeah, they didn't have any firearms.
They didn't have any firearms on them. We're just checking this out. But I don't know, man, because I'll tell you right now, it's one thing to see all the, but the wolfman kind of make you be a little uneasy. We've discussed it with a lot of people in the background.
Right?
Yeah, we've discussed it with a lot of people on air and off air. The wolfman would make you a little uneasy.
Well, I remember some other stories I've read about dogman encounters in areas. There's an area in Kentucky between some lakes, and there's a lot of dogman sightings down there. And, I mean, people even reported hearing them walk on their porches and stuff at night. Clawing.
I'll tell you what's funny to me personally.
This is terrifying.
Why is it that it's easier for me to think about there being little bitty tiny people in the woods, or being a big giant hairy hominid monkey man in the woods, or even people flying with big leathery bat wing? Why can I picture that, but I can't picture like a werewolf, like an upright walking? Why is that the one thing that's the jumping off point for people?
Because you don't want to believe that there's a beast like monster like that out there, right? But I'm with you. People will believe in Sasquatch, they'll believe in extraterrestrials, they'll believe in whatever. But the moment you start talking about werewolves, they're like, nah, come on.
You're like, come on.
But I mean, why not? Well, what I like the best about this listener's story is she had no idea that this was a phenomenon until she came across our show and heard us talking about dog men. She's like, I've had this encounter when I was early in life. I had no idea what it was. I had nothing to explain it. I didn't know that this was the whole thing.
Just kind
of now, because
accident.
Of our show, she's gone on the internet and started researching. She's found all kinds of things about dogmen. She's like, I had no idea that it was a phenomenon.
It's got to make you feel good, too, because you got to start thinking you're losing your mind. I mean, a lot of people have talked about having encounters or sightings with things, and they think they're going crazy. And then you start finding there's more people out there. You're like, whew, I just thought I was the only one. Like, I was losing grasp with reality.
Yeah, well, she said her mother's passed away now. But to her dying day, her mother and her always confirmed they would talk about it from time to time. You remember that? Yes, I remember that.
That's wild, man. I mean, it's fascinating. I'm jealous of anybody that has sightings of anything like that. Because like I said, I've never had any really cool anything outdoorsy like that. I'm jealous of sightings like that.
All right. Well, stick with us, folks. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to wrap this show up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
All right, folks. Hope you enjoyed the gnomes and the dog men. I know I did. I love stories like that.
I do, too.
I can't help it. I can't help the whole thing.
And just like you were talking in the beginning of the show, in the first during the news portion, you were talking about the little statuette of a werepanther. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are these dog men things? I mean, what if this werewolf, werepanther, this shape-shifting lycanthrope stories is it's not BS, and it's been something that's been going on for a long time. And even there in the jungle, they were seeing these upright walking panthers. I mean, who knows?
Maybe, right? Maybe. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Now, what was you telling me? We got a listener that had some good luck.
Well, we wanted to give a shout out to a young man by the name of Charlie Firth, or Charlie Filthy Firth. Now, he's a boxer, and he just won his first title fight this last Friday. So congratulations to you, sir. We always support fighters. Me and Cam have been involved in martial arts at some stage or form throughout our lives. And, you know, we really appreciate it when people follow the show that are also fellow boxers and things like that. Congratulations, Charlie. Great job. We hope to hear from you soon. And, you know, let us know about some more of your fights,
that's
man.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah. So send us some pics or some video clip of it. I want to check that stuff out.
Now this fight took place on the Isle of Sheppey in the UK, which is just outside of London.
Nice.
You know, just a little while east of London, according to Google Maps. I've never been there.
Yeah, for real. Well, I got to, you know, we started doing some things where I want to talk about some feel-good stories and stuff like that. And this is kind of a synchronicity thing that a friend of mine sent this to me kind of out of the blue. And it kind of hit close to home because this Tuesday, the day after you folks are listening to this show 3 years ago, I lost my aunt due to breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And she had, you know, struggled with it off and on and had beat it for a little while. And then, of course, it came back and she couldn't beat it this time. And so she ended up, like I said, 3 years ago, she passed away. And was really close to her. But anyhow, I got this sent to me and I thought it was an interesting thing is people doing stuff for people. It's a really cool thing. A fellow named Vinnie Myers. Folks, if you don't know anything about this, search this up. The Huffington Post did a good process on it. They also have done some shows. You can pull it all up. But basically, Vinnie Myers is a fella that he's a tattoo artist, and he does roughly 2,000 nipple tattoos every year. He's the man. He is the man for doing it.
That's his thing.
Well, he's all sleeved up and like a normal tattoo artist. But what he does is, for women that have full mastectomies,
uh-huh,
and they want to have either, they have, you know, augmentations done to bring their breast back, and even some of them that don't, they just, you know, want to leave it, but they still feel like, you know, when you don't have nipples, they take it all. It's just skin. You know,
right.
There's nothing there. He is actually known as one of the best around for tattooing to your skin tone, to everything, to bring back your nipple, to make you look like there's no difference again. So if somebody was to just see it out of the blue, you would not know. I mean, you'd have to get right up and go, oh, hell, that's a tattoo.
That's cool.
It is really cool. But, and one of the videos that I've watched on this thing, it really brings a lot of closure for these women. My aunt did not have that. She did not. She had the augmentation, but no nipples. And, you know, she didn't, you know, she was an older woman. She didn't care. It was, her and my uncle were married for 41 years when she passed away. So what did she care? You know, he didn't care. She didn't care. But I could understand if you were, a lot of women have an issue with it. I could only imagine being a single woman and going through it.
Right.
And I mean, it would end up wearing on you. So it's just one of those things that I was like, you know what? I want to give this guy a little bit of a shout out, folks. If you know somebody, if you have a mom or a sister or a wife or girlfriend, anything that's gone through this and they're having this problem, search up Mr. Vinnie Myers, VinnieMyers. Search him up. This fella is awesome at it. He's a great guy, too. So my hat's off to him. Thanks for doing what you do for humanity. Like I said, 2,000 a year, that's pretty good. Now, I do remember in one of the interviews that he was talking about that he said he was tired of doing it because he wasn't being able to showcase his artistic talent. And when he decided he was going to be done doing it, he got a phone call that night from his sister that she'd been diagnosed.
Synchronicity.
Yep. So he was like, nope, I'll continue to do this. This is what I'm here to do. This helps. So I'll do it. So,
man, that's,
you know, thank
that's
you for
pretty cool. Yeah.
There's so many bad things in the news and so many bad things out there on TV and everybody's just, let's start focusing more on the good things.
I agree.
If you focus more on it, you can make it outweigh the bad. And I say that's what we start doing. Let's start finding some better stuff.
Speaking of good things, if you like Expanded Perspectives, don't forget there's Expanded Perspectives Elite every Thursday.
You son of a gun.
That's right.
I don't know how you do this.
On the last episode, we were speaking about Friendship Island. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. So if you want to listen to that, join the club. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the link on the top right. Signing up's easy. And you can hear an additional show every Thursday. Now, certain months, there's actually 5 Thursdays. So we get 5 extra shows that month. If you have any cool stories, like we mentioned earlier in the program, be sure to email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Also, if you enjoy the show, be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. We really appreciate people's feedback, things like that. Everybody have a good week. Don't work too hard. For those elite members, we will speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll speak to you next Monday.
Sounds great, folks. Y'all take care. Give somebody a hug. Tell somebody you love them. Have a good week, and we will catch y'all later. Peace.
Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
Military veterans and active duty service members, you could become a certified cyber warrior with just 12 weeks of training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, and IT pros with these skills often enjoy abundant opportunity and a great lifestyle. Protect our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. SkillBridge and other VA benefits are available to those who qualify. Learn more at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP. That's mycomputercareer.edu/CWP.